Welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Rocher, the chef in a hat.
And I'm Katie O.
It's a lovely Seattle day out there. The crowd is enormous. They're lively. They're still actually following directions because they haven't gotten their sandwich yet.
That's right. Obedient audience.
Obedient audience.
Seven rows of beautiful.
I'm Tom Douglas. We're here at the Hot Stove Society, and we have our radio show here on Tuesday mornings. You're welcome to come join us at hotstovesociety.com. Be part of our studio audience. And enjoy the immediate company of the chef and the chapeau, Katie O, and myself. Mm-hmm. I'm owner of many of Seattle's fine restaurants, about 15 to be exact. Chef, how about you?
Only two.
Only two.
Only two.
Very fine.
But very fine.
Mm-hmm. Luke in Madison Valley and Lule downtown Seattle.
And you sprayed that toilet
and
stuff that you brought.
A brand new line of fragrances.
Yeah.
Chefinahatfragrances.com. Okay. There you go. Go shopping.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. The whole place
we have
is
a
reeking right now.
Diffuser, hand soap, and eau de toilette, and a beautiful smell of
it's the only perfume you get in the mason jar.
Fig, green tea, lime, and bergamot. Okay. Very refreshing. What do you think, ladies?
I like it.
You like it?
Oh. Yeah, they're saying they like
Nobody's
it.
Nobody's bowing no, so...
All right, Katie, what do you do?
What do I do? Well, I hang out with you two fine gentlemen every week on this lovely radio program. And in my actual working life, I work at Molly Moon's Homemade Ice Cream. I'm their sales and marketing director.
That sounds very exciting.
How much ice cream do you eat?
Time.
Except it's, but you know what people love to do? They love to go to the grocery store and get ice cream and eat it at home in their sweats.
I see.
There's we're celebrating, time.
How much we're celebrating Seafood 101 month with Chris Woodley of Groundfish Forum. We're sharing our favorite taste of the week, eating oysters with Robert Spalding. And, of course, at the end of our two-hour show, we're going to go do some knockdown trivia.
A drag-out fight?
A drag-out fight.
That's right.
How are you feeling today,
Digging
Tom?
Deep.
How are you feeling today?
Well, I got walloped last week, so I'm not feeling so confident today. Or maybe I'll ebb and then I'll flow.
Ooh, okay.
Ebb and flow.
Just saying.
Don't let it
saying,
stop.
Be careful out there. Okay, KDO.
Okay, we're going to go from ordinary to extraordinary with your knowledge and know-how. This is where we take an ordinary dish and make it extraordinary. And the first one comes from National Donut Day on November 5th. I love a good donut, Tom. I had a very, it was nearly my taste of the week, but now we're going to talk about it. A delicious donut here last week after a taping of the show.
Oh, did you now?
Mm-hmm. Can we talk about that?
Probably not. But I will say they are mochi-based, and they are quite delicious
they
and beautiful.
Really
I must say, I'm not a donut fan.
Uh-huh.
That was delicious.
Well, good.
It was.
I would
perfect,
buy that in a minute.
So if I was to make ordinary to extraordinary on donuts. One of the things about our donut is, you know, the problem with donuts, and the good part and the bad part about donuts is that they're all deep fried, right?
Yes.
And so our donut is actually baked, and yet it tastes like a donut.
Yes.
So that's kind of where I'll take it is from ordinary to extraordinary, is try different recipes on your cake donuts and bake them instead of frying them. And they really, when we tried them against each other, the only difference in flavor was you didn't taste the deep fryer.
Yeah.
Now, maybe that's just something that we're so used to, we don't really care.
Tom, when it's cold, it's so much better.
Yeah. It was
because a cold donut, the only bad thing about a cold donut is you do taste that frying oil.
Right.
Where if you have a baked item, you don't taste any oil, which is
and
much
so it's
present.
A much cleaner flavor.
Yeah.
And, of course, our donuts are gluten-free. So
there you go.
What's next on your list?
Nachos on November 6th.
You know what they call them, nachos?
Because they're mine. Hey, did you see the spot on the Food Network?
I don't have cable, Tom. What happened? Tell
what
me
happened
what happened
on the Food Network. Cantina Lena, our Cantina Lena nachos won best thing I ever ate.
Oh.
Best nachos I ever ate.
That's a great
for the
show.
Cadillac nachos.
And
so.
Who chose it as their favorite nacho?
I don't know. It didn't really matter to me.
So
you were just happy to get the recognition.
Yeah,
so
sure,
how do you make great nachos?
Well, I think kind of like... We looked at the nachos a little bit like we looked at serious pies. Like what? Everyone can make nachos, right?
Right.
But what makes them? What makes them like over the top?
Yeah.
And so one of the things I looked at the things I disliked about nachos,
right?
Which is like when you just put grated cheese, and in 1 minute it's all coagulated back like of the brick that it started out before you grated it.
Then you pull the whole sheet.
I know. I find it gross. So I wanted to get away from that. So I made a cheese sauce, but a real cheese sauce, not the non-dairy like you get out of Velveeta.
Right.
Velveeta, but real cheese sauce thickened with masa.
Oh, nice.
So it's got that extra corny flavor, but it's still a cheese sauce. Mm-hmm. And then I got a big, thick cast iron pan, and we put it into this cast iron pan on a trivet so that in 20 minutes it's still warm.
Right.
Which is something, you know, oddly enough, nobody had done that. Now if you look around town, everyone's doing this exactly the same thing. And I'm not trying to take credit for it. It just makes sense.
Yeah.
You know,
we're just happy to have warm nachos is what we're saying.
I know, exactly. Yeah. So there's that. And then we did what I don't like to do for myself personally was like we just went over the top on toppings. And to me, more is not necessarily better. So when I order the nachos, I just order the cheese nachos with maybe a little salsa, but everyone else orders the Cadillac nachos, which has the garlic fried pinto beans, the roasted pork,
it's like the Chicago pizza. It's a meal in its own.
Onion element.
But those are the ones that won the best thing I ever ate on the Food Network.
Wow. Well, they are delicious, and when I'm hankering nachos, I would never make them now. I just go and have them at the cantina.
I would just suggest if you have a cast iron pan, make your nachos in a cast iron pan. It holds the heat and keeps them
warm. It makes
warm.
Complete sense.
All right, what's the next thing?
All right, the next thing is we have apple pie. There's so many beautiful apple pies, or I'm sorry, apples in the markets right now. Thierry?
You know, I'm a big fan of making good dough, but I'm not a big fan of putting another layer on top, so I'm not going to do a pie. I'm going to make a tart. Which is very French of me. Mm-hmm. Which is the same thing as a pie, except there is no topping to it. I like my apples to be caramelized beautifully. So when I do an apple tart, what I like to do is pre-bake the dough first with some weight in it. You know, use some old rice or beans or something like that. And then keep the dough really nicely baked. Then put your apple sauce. Make an apple sauce. Use more flavor of apple than anything else. You do a beautiful apple sauce, melt down some apples, cook them down with a little bit of butter, finish them with a little bit of Calvados, which is basically an apple brandy, but use a good one because you're only putting like a shot in that sauce. But that will enhance the flavor and make it bring a different layer of flavor. And then slice your apple very thin and put them right on top, fan them, a little bit of sprinkled sugar on top, put that tart back in the oven, bake it so all the apples are nicely caramelized, and bingo mango, Bob's your uncle.
Bingo, bango.
Bob's your uncle. Well, you know, ever notice with Terry, a lot of times on when we go ordinary to extraordinary, he literally just does a classic apple tart a classic French apple tart,
right,
which isn't
right.
necessarily taking it out of bounds at all. It's just many of us don't make the effort to get to that classic place.
I was going to say that is extraordinary for a lot of us because many of us are not making French classics at home.
But you know what? I guarantee you it won't take you any longer to make it. That's the point.
All right. All right. Get over yourself. It's November, time for giving, and Tamara Murphy, Monica Dimas, and Tara Clark are here to tell us about how they're giving back with Chefs Plus Together Seattle. You're listening to the Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotero, the chef in the hat.
And I'm Katie O.
And we have a very important segment coming up here with Tamara Murphy and Monica Dimas and Tara Clark, founder of Believe, Love, Unite. Monica's with Neon Taco, et cetera, a few different joints. And, of course, Tamara has the incredible Terra Plata up on Capitol Hill. Right next to the roastery, which is the Starbucks roastery, where I used to have a serious pie as your neighbor. Best business deal I ever made. Was that?
We miss you.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. Anyway, so tell us about this huge event you're doing, and it's on Wednesday, November 14th, with over 70 local restaurants.
We're actually over 120 now.
Wow, nice job.
It's a citywide event. We got together because we were concerned about the policies that were being put into place for immigrant families, and it started as a sort of fundraiser for reunification of families, and since then it's sort of broadened a little bit to include more immigration issues, but now it's a citywide event, as I said, 120 plus restaurants, bars, cafes, dessert shops, joining in to raise funds for the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. And just because of how atrocious this administration is treating immigrants and its ongoing awful policies, it really has motivated a lot of people to come together and raise money for that.
So Tamara, you know, this is restaurant-centric, I'm sure, because we are a business of immigrants. If you look at the first line for immigrants when they first get to our country, restaurants are a natural place for them to end up. I've known so many over the years, every wave of immigration that's happened in our country has come through our restaurants, I feel. What got you into this?
Well, again, like Monica, initially, Erica Burke sent out an email and her concerns for what was happening. And of course, as you said, our restaurants are filled with Latinos and other ethnic groups. And I personally had a few on my staff that was very concerned. And they're my family, and we are family to them. And so it became extremely personal. And consequently, not just my restaurant family and other restaurants that we know that were picked up by ICE for this or that reason. I also have a very close friend who married a gentleman from Ethiopia a couple of years ago and then was picked up by ICE simply because he got here when he was 19 and he's 40-something and he hadn't filled out the appropriate papers. Mm-hmm. So very personal reasons, and spent 6 months in the detention center down there in Tacoma, and I visited, and so it was just right up. I just really wanted to be involved in this.
You were living the headlines.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
So Tara, tell us about how you are running this project.
Again, through Erica Burke with Volunteer Park Cafe. I'm the founder. It's now Believe, Love, Unite. It started as the Spread Love 2017 campaign, centered around lawn signs, that in this house we believe Black Lives Matter, women's rights are human rights. So if you're familiar with those signs, I am a photographer, not a lawn sign person, but became very motivated by what is going on in our country, and I really believe in people. And it is about the amazing people in our country, and that we need to stand up and come together as a collective and be seen, and the power of collective is really amazing. And so for me, Erica, Volunteer Park was one of the restaurants and shops that had carried my signs early on. And then when she let me know that she had put out a message to try to create something for the Families Belong Together effort, I came to a meeting, and it's evolved. And what's happening on November 14th is hopefully the first of many different events. Seattle Together is what we formed as an organization with chef owners and other friends that have gotten involved. And we're hoping it'll be a human rights to raise awareness for human rights and fundraising, you know, for different efforts that are happening. There's great efforts on the ground and we can contribute to and use our collective power to make change.
So all the funds go to the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. Tamara, Monica, where do we go from here? I mean, people just go out to eat at these restaurants, and about 10% of what you spend at the restaurant that night will get returned to the Northwest Immigrants' Rights Project.
Correct. So you can go to the website, which is togetherseattle.org, and it'll have a list of everyone who's participating. So you can also donate directly to Northwest Immigrant Rights Project on their website, and there's a link on the website as well that directs you there. But the point is just to go out, support these businesses, and also support the cause.
Yeah, it's mostly support the cause.
Mostly support the cause. And if you are a listener to this radio program, that means you love food on some level, and you love food that is probably brought to you by immigrant cultures, especially if you love all sorts of food. And, you know, we all eat out so much anyway. This is a perfect opportunity to just go out on this particular day and contribute to a cause that has given you personally probably so much in terms of delicious food, right?
If you come to my joint, you're coming to an immigrant's restaurant.
That's right.
That's right.
We happen to have one in our midst.
That's right. As well, there's still an opportunity for other restaurants out there to sign up on the biz link. It'll say, when you go to the website, say biz sign up. So there's still plenty of time for coffee shops and bakeries and anyone else that has a food industry, a food establishment to sign up. So
is the goal to go to different cities across America after this?
I think the goal is maybe to expand later on to, into other issues that we're experiencing. But for now, it's just Seattle. And, you know, if other cities want to take it up, we'd be happy to organize that with them. But for now, it's just to get Seattle to come together and really help on this front.
And again, like you said, it's in the news every day. I can't, you know, not but wake up and have about six notifications on my phone about the newest wave of laws that are trying to be passed. I mean, it's a really important issue that's going to affect everyone.
Tara, can I just ask you, I mean, you were going to add something, but I also like you to read this paragraph right here, that a quote from you down there.
I was going to say, also, it's about coming together to fundraise, but it's also coming together, get out of your homes, be with people, connect with new people, and have an amazing experience together, and have incredible food. I will be at Luke at 7:30 on the 14th. I'm very excited, and so it's a way to get out. So the paragraph is, I believe in the power of community. When individuals bring their unique gifts, perspectives, and experiences together, the possibility to create real change is amazing. I am hopeful the Together Seattle events will bring individuals, businesses, and communities together and be a part of the change we want to see in our world. I had the honor of interviewing Terry Wright as he was finishing up with Rovers about my project was around immigrants. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about immigrants to me. It was about people. And everyone had told me, oh, this is a great immigrant story. Everyone has immigrant stories. And for me, we need to see everyone as people. And so wrapping ourselves, and you are a wonderful example in the city of Seattle of what immigrants can do in our country, in our community. And I'm very grateful for being here.
Yeah, and enriching our lives, absolutely.
And enriching our lives.
Thank you, Monica. Thank you, Tamara. Thank you, Tara. Up next, we're going to taste some oysters with Chef Robert Spalding of Elliott's Oyster House on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. Tom Douglas here.
Terry Rocher, the chef in the hat.
And Katie O.
And 'tis the season for oysters.
Yes.
And I see a little glint in your eye.
As well you should. I'm a big oyster lover.
And I have never been.
I know this about you, which I find so bizarre. It's so weird to me. Like, it's a delicious, savory, sometimes quite briny treat.
I know.
Seems right up your alley.
My wife loves them. I open them for her all the time.
Mm-hmm. That's very sweet of you. You're at least doing your part.
Matter of fact, it's our 35th wedding anniversary tomorrow, and I'm opening her oysters.
Yay! Happy anniversary, Jackie. I'm sorry you had to go through this.
You made it, Jackie. You did it.
She did something terribly wrong in her last life to end up in this situation.
Yes, karmatically speaking. Yes. Who knows what happened there?
All right, Chef Robert Spalding is here, the Elliott's Oyster House down there on the waterfront. He's here to talk about a bunch of different kinds of oysters that he's brought with him. Hello. Hey.
Hello. Good morning, chefs.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I'm here because it's oyster season, mm-hmm. and Oyster New Year is coming up. It's the 26th annual Oyster New Year. It benefits the Puget Sound Restoration Fund. And the reason we hold it in the fall is because oysters are good to go. They're packing on a lot of glycine and glycogen starch to get through the long, cold winter when they're not going to be feeding. So it's one of the best times of the year to experience oysters. I brought a bunch of different oysters here. Typically in the Puget Sound area, you can find four different species. There used to be five, but right now, four species. And those are Pacific, Kumamoto, Virginica, and Olympia. And we've got representations of all of those here. Some of them are easier to shuck. Some of them are a little bit harder. Wild oysters tend to be a little bit harder from Hood Canal. And lots of tumbled oysters from this region are pretty easy to shuck.
They are quite different in size. You have these little tiny guys, which I'm going to assume are the Kumamotos. Is that
no,
true?
No, they're Olympia.
The little guys are Olympias, the only oyster native to the Puget Sound area. And those
so
are
petite.
Those are a little bit harder to shuck if you're into shucking oysters.
Mm-hmm.
It can be fun to get those down. It takes
a little
bit of
finesse. If you're not into shucking oysters, it's going to be hard to eat them. I guarantee
you. I don't mind shucking the Olympias. You have to have a really tiny pointed knife.
You do.
To get into those guys.
You kind of choke up on it like a baseball bat.
Mm-hmm. So I didn't realize the Kumos were a different species than the Pacific.
They are, yeah. Kumamoto's mm-hmm. came over when people on the west coast of America were searching for oysters that would successfully grow over here. And Kumamoto's is one of the ones that really kind of took off.
And it's a fairly new on the market. It's fairly new. It's one of the latest one we've had.
It is. Ready accessibility and availability is a little bit of a newer thing over the last 15 or so years.
Right, right.
Can I hear a little bit more about this oyster in New York? Because I've heard about it quite a bit throughout the industry. As you said, it's the 26th year of doing this particular event.
It sure is, yes. We're going to have right around 25, 26,000 oysters, which are going to be consumed.
1,000.
Yes, yes. About 27 or 28 different varieties, and they'll all be consumed within a four-hour period.
And how many shuckers?
With the folks that come from the different oyster farms, we're looking at maybe 45 or 50.
Wow.
Those guys are going to be moving their wrist a lot that night.
Yeah, there's going to be a little bit of ice packs going on.
I was going to say, everyone's icing their wrists afterwards in coolers.
Wow,
and
that's a lot of oysters opening.
And this is all down at Elliott's, correct?
It is all down at Elliott's. It starts at 4 and ends at 8 o'clock.
And it's on New Year's Eve, you said?
Oyster New Year's Eve.
Oyster New Year's
which
Eve.
Is the usually the first Saturday in November. This year it'll be on the 3rd.
Okay.
And yeah, I hear it's a big party. So how many people kind of come through in that 4 hours?
We're looking at about 1,000 folks.
Wow.
And so that 1,000 folks polishes off, you know, 26,000
oysters.
When
I think of myself, I eat at least 2 dozen.
So. Do you really, Terry? You go for it.
Oh, yeah. I can.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You can do it.
As a child, we ate oysters. It was a celebration. You know, it was the holiday season. We'd go, and the only reason that when you said during this time of the year, the oysters, you know, are the best. I'm like, yeah, I don't remember picking oysters when it was a nice day outside. It's always a crummy day, very cold. And December 21st is the equinox, and that's when my dad and I, we're not from the ocean, so we're about 40 miles from the ocean, not 20 miles from the ocean. So we drive to the ocean, spend the whole day with chisel and hammer, big burlap bag, walk in the mud, and then all the way to the rocks that normally were not exposed, and then we chiseled all those oysters, and we bring back like a 50-pound of oysters, and my dad would drag and bring back, and we put it in the cellar. We'd take all the oysters and make sure they were, side up, and we keep it in the cellar for 2 weeks, no refrigeration. I mean, it's a cold wine cellar, but we just keep it in there, and we use it for Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve, and I have a spread of oysters. And I don't understand when I came to America and they were like, you go to a restaurant and they go, 6 oysters. I'm like, okay, so how many times do we do that? Because 6 oysters is nice, but that's just barely getting me going here.
And yeah. They're tiny.
Yeah. I'm like, you know, 6 oysters is not that much. And it's not filling, you know. People always talk about diet. Man, eat oysters. They're not filling. You can eat, like, as many as you want.
Well, you're also working at it, usually, as you're consuming, which I think is probably...
Yeah. Chef Robert Spalding is working.
That's right.
Chef Terry is just eating it.
Chef Spalding is working.
See the difference in size.
It's very true. Robert, can you maybe tell us, if you're new to eating oysters, what the best way to approach this product is from a consuming standpoint? Do you use the mignonette? Do you use the lemon? Do you just go for it just straight up?
Sure. So as far as individual taste goes and how adventurous you might be with trying new foods, if you might be a little bit apprehensive about trying oysters for the first time, I would recommend going for a smaller Pacific or Kumamoto oyster, probably from the South Puget Sound, maybe a little bit less brine. Some sweetness and cucumber and melon flavors. They're a little bit more approachable than, say, an Olympia, which is really, really packed with minerality
right. And
just tangy. Go for the smaller ones, and if you like them, continue to ask the oyster shucker to give you other oysters from different areas and see what you like as far as your oyster sensibility goes. It's important to go to a place where the shuckers and or servers really know their oysters, because they can guide you through your first oyster experience.
So as a rule of thumb, if you're a customer, you want to buy oysters, what's the best recommendation? I mean, the number one thing, you guys all know this probably here, but it is very important to not buy oysters that are saying hi to you, like wide open.
Yes.
You want to stay away from shellfish that's not in ice. There's a few key components.
Yes, if you walk into an establishment, ideally, when I walk into an establishment, I'm looking for a place that's fairly clean. The person that's shucking the oyster is put together, looks articulate, can talk about the oysters that they're shucking well, and that way I know that they know about the oysters and they probably, therefore, know how to treat the oysters.
Correct.
If I get an oyster that on the tray that doesn't have a lot of liquor in it, there's not a lot of juice, it's attached to the shell still, anything like that, that's kind of a warning sign.
It is often my first recommendation when people, you know, at Lule or whatever, they always ask me, so what else can I do in Seattle? And I always tell them, you got to go down the shore and, you know, on the pier and then go to Elliott and get some oysters, you know, get some nice array and even some crab, you know, put that on the table and have a nice Seattle experience.
Absolutely. Come on down and try some oysters. It's the season.
Yeah, absolutely.
So are you totally, chefs, are you totally against cooking any of these oysters? Or do you own, is it sacrilege to cook an oyster for you, Robert?
I don't think there's any sacrilege as far as anyone, how they want to try an oyster.
No, of course.
I had a gentleman from Texas ask me for Tabasco sauce, and I was just playing with him. I said, Tabasco? And he was kind of offended. He said, is there anything wrong with that? No, sir. Let me get your Tabasco for you.
Wrong if you're in Texas.
It's regional. However you've enjoyed oysters in the past is great. I love cooked oysters. I like a nice fried oyster in some buffalo sauce that has bacon grease in it instead of...
Oh, my.
Wow.
That got Katie's attention.
See, I'm not that big on cooking the oysters fried like that. That's not me, but I'm definitely... Right now we have a scallop dish with a beurre blanc finished with diced oysters in it, and that's basically warming up the oysters, and as it comes to the table, it's nice because it gives a beautiful brininess to your sauce, and I think it works really well as a dish. So
I love cooked oysters. I've had some delicious oyster stews. In fact, I think, Tom, you used to do one. I don't know if you still do. At SeaTown, which is kind of a creamier broth, but it's not thick and heavy like we think of chowders.
It's literally, like half and half with shucked oysters in it.
Oh, that's probably why I like it. Yeah, I think maybe, there we go.
That's what you like it so much.
I got off oysters. Maybe my mother-in-law used to make oyster stuffing for the turkey. Oh, my God. Poor thing, she's gone now, but...
We still talk about her terrible stuffing, though.
I think that might have been the reason.
That's her legacy, unfortunately.
Stuffing finally got her, yeah, exactly. Okay, Robert Spalding from Elliott's, thank you so much for Oyster 101. The event is sold out, so you'll have to get on the list for next year. That would be a good thing to do, Oyster New Year. Be fun, and I'm sure people come back every year.
They do. We've got returners for many years in a row. Thank you very much, chef.
All right.
Pleasure.
Chris Woodley, Executive Director of the Groundfish Forum, is going to join us next on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show from the Hot Stove Society. Thank you for joining us. Wherever you happen to be, in your car, in your garden,
anywhere.
On an airplane.
I
listened on an airplane yesterday.
Did you?
Just saying thank you. Thank you very much. Chris Woodley is here. He's the executive director of the Groundfish Forum. It's a trade association comprised of 5 member companies that operate 19 trawl catcher processor vessels in the federally managed fisheries of the Bering Sea, Aleutian Islands, and the Gulf of Alaska. Sounds fun.
Sounds like a big job.
It is fun, yes. And it's a Seafood 101 month, so thanks for having me here today.
Absolutely. I think the whole month of October was. We've now creeped into November. It's almost Election Day. Mm-hmm. Get out there and vote, everybody.
That's right. Super important.
Yes, indeed. So tell us about the fishery. Tell us about groundfish and why we should be eating other fish than just salmon and halibut and cod.
Good morning. So groundfish is just one of the many fish that... that are harvested sustainably in Alaska. And I think down here, you know, people are aware of crab and salmon and halibut, but there's a whole component of the fishing industry that people aren't necessarily aware of down here in Seattle, and groundfish is one of those. So what I brought today was some flathead sole. Mm-hmm. So flathead sole is a flatfish that's harvested in the Bering Sea using trawl gear. Sustainable fisheries. It's rated as a best choice on the Monterey Bay Aquarium seafood choice list. And and that's just one of the many different kinds of fish that we harvest up there. Other things that we harvest are like rockfish, aca mackerel, Pacific cod. And those are all sustainably harvested fisheries, and you know, great choice for to people to look at when they're looking to expand their seafood diets.
Which is something we really badly need, is to expand our diet onto a more diversified items, because salmon and halibut are going to disappear eventually if we all eat the same thing. I mean, that's the problem with our diet, is we eat the same stuff all the time. So you're right. It's nice of you to bring this to the market, bring a little diversification. And a fillet of sole is something that used to be very popular, but somehow seems to have disappeared.
Well, I think for me it disappeared off my menus because I was using the local gray sole, which I found to be kind of mushy, and it's just not a particularly good fish. I love the local, or even the Alaskan Petrolli sole, where it has a little bit more firm flesh, or the lemon sole or the Dover sole out of the East Coast to me is a little bit firmer. But that local gray sole is just not my favorite fish. A wreck sole is perfectly delicious. Mm-hmm. So are you getting all of the different kinds? I mean, these are pristine, thick, luscious-looking fillets.
Yeah, so we harvest yellowfin sole, rock sole, flathead sole, Kamchatka flounder, arrowtooth flounder, Alaska plaice. There's a whole bunch of different flatfish in the Bering Sea, and we harvest all of those fish. And then some of the stuff, like you're mentioning, like wreck sole and things like that, those are also things that we harvest, much smaller amounts. So as you move farther north, they're just not as abundant. That's primarily a West Coast fish.
Chris, can you paint a picture for all of us who maybe aren't as wise to the fishing game as you are in terms of how these fish are caught? I'm hearing words like trowel, and I'm thinking just a big old net just scraping the ocean floor. But that can't. You tell me.
Yeah. Again, we're a trawl fishery, and so we use what's called a modified trawl sweep. So back in the old days, back in like the mid '80s, there was a lot of concerns over habitat impact of the nets that trawlers were using. And so over the years, there's been, you know, continued focus by like National Marine Fisheries Service and the fishing industry to reduce the impacts of our gear. And so in 2011, after years of experimentation with using different kinds of nets and different kinds of gear, what the industry was able to develop was a fishing gear that where it reduced the bottom impact by 90%, but still caught fish, and that's what you got to do at the end of the day, right? You got to be able to catch fish.
What you're talking about is by catch. You're talking about if you're going to try to fish one fish in your net, you'd end up with tuna and dolphins or whatever, turtle. Other things,
right? Well, nothing like that. I mean, we don't get sea mammal bycatch or anything like that. Our bycatch is primarily fish or shellfish that we're not looking to harvest.
Mm-hmm.
So typically those like in our fishery, our bycatch is less than 0.5% of what we're actually targeting. So we're 99.6% efficient in what we do.
I mean, one thing,
but
that
you
I,
still get some bycatch.
Yeah.
That's with every fishery.
Right, of course.
One thing that I've learned throughout the month of October during our Seafood 101 series is that the Alaskan fisheries and, you know, the U.S. fisheries in general are just so well managed. It's very heartening to hear these things when we are thinking so much about the environment right now and how to best spend our dollars to contribute back to resources that we want to promote and sustain. And again, here you are telling us about another great way to support an economy.
Mm-hmm. And for consumers, the easy way to look at it is number one, look at when you're shopping for fish, you know, Alaska seafood is an easy go-to. All of our fish are certified by the Marine Stewardship Council as sustainable, and there's a blue label on the product that says Marine Stewardship Council MSC. Ours are also certified by the State of Alaska Responsible Fishery Management Program. So that's an easy way for consumers to make good seafood choices and know that the fish that they're buying is sustainable. I was just going to tying back to the bycatch and the habitat issues for a second, that's all part of the consideration that's made when they look at sustainability, is what are the impacts on the environment? What are the impacts on other fish? So that's all considered when those sustainability ratings are put together.
And there's really no excuse when you're in the grocery store. You can might want to say to yourself, you're in front of the fish counter, say to yourself, God, I don't really remember which shrimp I was supposed to buy or not.
Mm-hmm.
We all have a cell phone. There's apps on your cell phone. You can check in 10 seconds whether or not you should be buying that and not just making excuses of why you don't know if you should be or not.
Yeah.
So that's just something that I would remind everyone. Just download the Marine Stewardship Council's app, and you could figure that out very
Most likely, if it says Alaska on it, it's good stuff.
It's good stuff, yeah.
We're going to be at the Pacific Marine Expo in a couple of weeks, I want to say, from noon to 1:30 on Monday, November 19th at CenturyLink Field Event Center for a special recording of the Seattle Kitchen Show. It's the largest commercial fishing expo and workboat show on the West Coast.
One of my favorite
things.
You're
going to be there?
I will be there.
You're going to be there.
With all the big engines.
Yeah, exactly.
With all... Okay, Katie.
Now they've got all those amazing engines.
It's true. It's true.
I'm not making this up. We've been there for years.
Just like those big engine on
it's very impressive.
Coming up next, we're going to share our favorite taste of the week, both at home and from around town on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Hello, and welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotero, the chef in the hat.
And I'm Katie O.
We still have a big second hour for you. Of course, our Taste of the Week, the chefs Michael Solomonov and Steve Cook were over at the Book Larder, and Sarah went and got a little interview from them. Pastry Chef's Corner with Brittany Bartleben every week. And, of course, we're going to wrap up with the Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge.
Mm-hmm.
I'll jump in with my favorite taste of the week, and I think it's not so much about the taste, it's more about the technique. Made some mac and cheese for a new joint that we're working on with Nordstrom down in Las Vegas at the Fashion Mall, and it reminded me of how easy it is to take something probably not super healthy like mac and cheese.
And
I like how you're still doubting that.
Well, I mean, what I will say is with our mac and cheese, we use real cream and real butter and real cheese.
Right.
But how much of that you're supposed to eat is probably the not real healthy part. But anyway, so what we did was we took half the pasta out and substituted cauliflower for it, right? So I really liked that. That technique is one thing. The second technique with that is that instead of making whole, like your whole meal being that mac and cheese, even though it has cauliflower in it, we then made a raw cauliflower salad on top with lots of green herbs to kind of reinforce and change the texture.
Right.
So reinforce the cauliflower,
right,
but also get rid of some of the mushy texture of cauliflower mac and cheese,
mm-hmm,
and add that crisp cauliflower on top. And I really think from a texture perspective and a health perspective, it's a nice thing.
Of course.
And it's easy. It just struck me as I was putting that dish out on Thursday that how easy this would be to accomplish at home, no matter what you do. So down there we did the same thing with meatballs, right? We did kind of a meatball and shell casserole. A tomato sauce casserole with the cheese, mm-hmm, classic kind of tomato sauce pasta.
Right.
And then we took the meatballs and browned them and then made a salad with fresh fennel and fresh parsley and all with the meatballs on top, hot griddled meatballs. And again, it just freshens up the dish and gives you that fresh herb and more what I feel like tastes more healthy.
I would like some of that right now. That sounds delicious.
No,
tough noogies.
I agree with you, Tom.
When's the last time someone gave you a noogie?
It's been a while. Are we going to do it after
like
the show?
Over the counter right now,
I know,
rubbing you.
I know
your,
you.
A bald
you kind
spot.
Of got your hands in a fist.
Okay. I think it is definitely part of the life we live in today. Is to split the sizes and make it diversified in texture and diversified in flavor,
and a little bit healthier.
Yeah, no, of course. Nice. Yeah.
What's your favorite taste of the week?
Well, I made a batch of quince and pineapple jam this week, sauce actually.
Mm-hmm.
So I had this beautiful Maui pineapple my daughter-in-law-to-be brought me, and it's been upside down in my kitchen for about a week and a half, so it was perfectly ripe. You know, if you get a pineapple and it's not entirely ripe, you just turn it upside down.
Sounds like an old wives' tale to me, like an old French mom's tale.
Well, it was gorgeous, ripe and juicy and delicious. And I diced that and put it into with my quince. I have a quince tree in the backyard. So I diced, I peeled and diced all that quince and made a beautiful sauce. And I had a very long time. I had a half bottle of late harvest Riesling from 2007 from Navarro, a Navarro vineyard from California. I opened that and I put that in there. Mm. Oh, man, this sauce is yummy. Yeah. It just reminded me
what'd
how...
What did you make a sauce for?
It just reminded me how simple it can be to make something really delicious.
I made that's a very sweet sauce. What's going on?
No, no, it's not going to be. It's not going to be that sweet because I didn't add sugar. I just add a little bit of sugar. Don't forget, quince are very demanding in sugar.
So, what's the sauce for?
It's a sauce like a
like for duck breakfast. Or pork chop or
for breakfast for pork chop. You could use it for pork chop, okay. But it's a sweet. You know, it's kind of like something you put on your toast in the morning.
A confiture.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. I had some great tastes this week. Can I say two? Can I have two tastes?
If one? You can hurry, I don't know how much time we have.
I'm going to be really fast. One is Howler Monkey, which is a hot sauce that I have just now decided to put on all the things that I like hot sauce. And apparently it's this Aji Chombo, which is a particular type of pepper from Panama. So it's a Panamanian hot sauce. You have to buy it online. I just happened upon it. And I love it. So I'm just putting a little plug out there for this new hot sauce that I really, really like.
So you don't know anybody that made it? You're just plugging it?
No, it's called Howler Monkey. It's you can buy it from PanamaHotSauce.com.
Okay.
It's very delicious. You got to get
like
it online.
It. Yeah.
Okay. Second taste was I took a little recipe from one of your cookbooks, Tom. Mm-hmm. I believe it's Big Dinners.
You might say I wrote the book on
it. You might have written the book on it. It's actually, I believe, Jackie's recipe.
Oh,
but
yes.
I had brunch with my lady friends the other day, and I made the strata after we had that really great conversation last week about bread pudding.
Did you make it the night before and let it sit?
I made it the night before. I went to Rain Shadow Meats. I got some mild Italian sausage. I had a little loaf from Grand Central Baking. I had some Beecher's flagship cheese. It was like a full-on Seattle brunch experience.
What kind of greens did you use?
I used La Cienega kale.
La Cienega kale, perfect.
Yeah, yeah. The chard didn't look quite as nice where I was, so I went with the kale, and it was delicious. It was such a hit. I mean, like, that is... That's a whole
on
meal
that one,
in itself.
I think you almost have to overcook it, right? Because
yes.
You almost have to get it so that you want those crusty sides with the custardy interior.
Well, I was with two girlfriends, and I was like, do you want a corner or a middle
slice? Is this when you broke our date? You were with your two girlfriends?
No, I broke our cocktail date. Oh. Do you want to have another date?
No.
Okay.
So
I ruined
had
it.
Your chance.
Quick question. Hey, we were talking about bread pudding, right?
Bread pudding, okay. Yes.
Strata.
Strata. Strata in particular.
Okay.
But
strata.
Everyone wanted those edgy, crispy bits. Mm-hmm. But the thing is like, to your point, Tom, I do think you have to cook it a little bit longer so that whole top kind of becomes one delicious, buttery, crispy crouton with all that cheesy goodness.
The problem with cooking it enough, it's a little bit like overcooking your pizza, is that it tends to break the cream and the cheese into a little bit of a greasy
thing. Yeah, I don't think anyone cared. I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, I think when you get
that is the problem with that, right?
Plus, the whole house smells like so delicious.
Yeah, it's almost a little bit, it reminds me of kind of like Thanksgiving for breakfast because it has a lot of those flavors. I ended up putting a little bit of sage that I had in the fridge and some fresh thyme. And so those aromatics were in there on top of some mushrooms and the sausage and the cheese. It was delicious.
So many people tell me now, because that book's been out for about 10 years or even longer, and a lot of people actually email me and say they've made it for the Christmas morning breakfast, which is how it got in the book, right? Because Jackie always makes that.
It's the absolute perfect thing. When you know you have things to do the next morning, but you want a really delicious breakfast, you just pop it in the oven, and after an hour and 10 minutes of letting it sit for a second, you're ready to go.
Yeah, and if you're making dinner the night before, it's easy to just to make that dish for the morning.
Right.
And it goes in raw into your fridge.
Covered.
And just sits there, right?
Just marinating in all that sausagey, herby, mushroomy goodness. So savory.
Ready.
All right. Up next, Sarah Leibovitz, our production assistant here, went to talk to Michael Solomonoff at the book larder during his visit. I wish he had come here, that
guy. Yeah, me too.
Guy. And we're going to find out about that on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. And we are back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show from the Hot Stove Society. We're in our second hour. You can always find us online at a podcast somewhere.
That's right. Wherever you stream your podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, Cairo Radio app.
All right. What's up, Sarah Leibovitz?
Hey, so I went last week and met up with the wonderful chefs Michael Solomonov and Steve Cook. They just came out with a new cookbook called Israeli Soul. They own a restaurant in Philadelphia called Zahav.
Yes, I've been there.
Yeah. Pretty good one from what I hear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Israeli Soul book is also amazing. Uh-huh. It's filled with different recipes, and I got to talk to them about making Israeli food.
Nice. Let's listen in.
I'm Mike Solomonov, chef and co-owner of Zahav Restaurant in Philly.
And I'm Steve Cook, also a co-owner of Zahav Restaurant in Philadelphia. I think the common misconception about what Israeli cuisine is people just assume it's Middle Eastern food, and it's that, but it's a lot more than that because you have over 100 cultures, many of which have arrived within the last 100 years. So you have all these different backgrounds bringing Jewish food, which has been shaped in the diaspora by Jewish law and kosher law, coming back to one place. And the exchange of ideas and the exchange of dishes that happened in Israel in the last 70 years has really created something that is uniquely Israeli.
So I know people in the U.S., when they think of Israeli food, they think of hummus and they think of falafel, which is good, but I'm assuming is not really the only thing you eat in Israel. What are some of what Israelis would think of as kind of the core foods of Israel?
The core food of Israel? I mean, that is just a very difficult thing. I mean, everybody, yeah, hummus and falafel, of course, those aren't Israeli. The most Israeli thing is probably sabich, which Steve spent like 10 years researching on how it came to be, so I'll let him answer that. But I think that what makes something Israeli is really the mishmash of all of it together. It's the different kinds of salads that you get depending on where your parents and grandparents are from in Israel on the Shabbat table. It's how deep into the Galilee you are, whether you're experiencing Bedouin or Druze or Palestinian cuisine. It's the Yemenite food that you have Saturday morning, sometimes out of a kiosk, you know, baked overnight baked breads. And it's like the bakeries that have, different tchinas, different halvas, rogalach, which come from, the West, basically, or they come from Europe, and borekas, which come from the Ottoman sort of areas. And it's all those things sort of mixed together, shaken up. But sabich is the most Israeli dish.
We write in the book that sabich is sort of the story of Israel stuffed inside of a pita because it was created by Iraqi Jews when they came to Israel in the 1950s out of things that literally came out of their Sabbath overnight stew. So eggplant, hard-cooked eggs that all cooked overnight in the stew. In Iraq, those foods were breakfast on the Sabbath morning before they went to synagogue, and then they'd come back for lunch and eat the rest of the stew. Well, in Israel, because of Israelis' love for stuffing things inside of a pita, these Iraqi immigrants in the 1950s in Ramat Gan, somebody got the great idea to make a sandwich out of it. And that's the sandwich called sabich, which is, sliced hard-boiled eggs, fried eggplant, amba, which is a pickled mango condiment that came from Iraq via India originally. It's a sandwich that doesn't exist in Iraq, only really doesn't exist anywhere outside of Israel.
You were saying, that you did a lot of research on just that one food. What was the research like for this book as a whole, figuring out what recipes to choose?
I mean, the research was really going to Israel for 8 days and eating at 82 restaurants, approximately 80 of which were excellent. So it was really trying to figure out what we could include in a book that kept growing as we were writing it. But we talked to so many different restaurateurs, some young chefs, but also some people whose families have been doing one thing in a small restaurant for generations and generations and sustaining their family that way. So we really wanted to capture that in this book, sort of, and that's where the title, Israeli Soul, I think speaks to the role of food in creating the fabric of a culture, especially in a young country like Israel.
What role does it play in Israel in particular? When you think about different cultures making foods, there's often like a very different mindset depending on the culture. What is that for Israel?
Well, because of the history of the country, most Israelis trace their lineage, two, three generations at most back to a totally different place in the world that they're effectively cut off from. So how do we preserve our heritage? Food is one of the big ways that we do it. And so when you asked about what real Israeli food is, it's, well, it's kind of the food that your grandmother cooked. It's this Sabbath stew, you know, dafina if you're Moroccan, or tabbit if you're Iraqi. That's really, I think, what it boils down to, a way to preserve your heritage. And then, you know, there's the, then when they all kind of got together in Israel in this close proximity, what was also fascinating to see was how one culture might adopt something from another culture, like sloug, a Yemenite green chili paste, which was, you know, very, you know, originally very much limited to the Yemenite table, is now basically on every table in Israel.
And for an absolute beginner who picks up your book, what's the first recipe they should try out? What's an easy one that they can do as a tester, kind of?
Well, it's hard. I mean, the five-minute hummus is, like, probably the one. We really designed it to be not non-alienating, really sort of measured. You buy two cans of chickpeas, one jar of tahina. You don't have to, like, dig your fingers into the jar of tahina and get schmutz all over you. And, you know, it's very, very simple, and I think most people want and sort of crave and need good hummus in their life. So this is the way to do it.
I went to Israel last year, and having the hummus and pita there, it was very different from anything I'd had in the U.S. before. What makes it so different? What is it about the Israeli recipe or how it's made there that makes it better, pretty much?
Well, I feel like Israeli hummus and Palestinian hummus is about the tahina. It's not the garlic, lemon, what we're used to here. It's definitely not served cold. And it's eaten basically as a meal. I mean, it can be... when you were in Israel, did you eat it for breakfast or lunch?
Lunch.
So you should have it for breakfast, too. It's really, really good. Or it can be a dip, but it can really be enjoyed as a bowl by itself, you know? And I feel like that... there's something neutral about it when it's really about the richness and the nuttiness and the relationship between the tahina and the chickpeas. And we emphasize the use of tahina, or the importance of tahina in Zahav, and that definitely carries, I think, through everything that we do. Tahina as being the sort of mother sauce.
For ingredients like tahina, or things that might be more difficult to find in the U.S., where do you suggest people find them, or are there substitutions that they should make instead?
We use a company called Sum Tahina, which you can get, you know, basically anywhere, or order from anywhere. As far as substitution, I mean, there are good quality tahinas now, but I wouldn't make like sunflower tahina and do that. I'm sure that stuff is very good. That's just not our style. We like to keep it a little real.
Well, I think that's about all of the questions I had.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, so at the end of the day, when you go to these events and you talk to the authors and you see the food, would you buy the book?
Absolutely. And this book is big. You are getting a lot when you get this book. And I went to Israel last year, and the food was incredible. Getting to actually make some of it or learning how to is just a great opportunity and something you don't see a lot of, especially here in Seattle.
We look forward to tasting some of that.
That's right, Sarah.
Samples.
Up next, it's the Baker's Corner on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Time to return to the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Jerry Rotero, the chef in the hat.
And I'm Katie O.
It's the Hot Stove Society, and it's the Baker's Corner. Chef Brittany Bartleben is here from the Dahlia Bakery. Welcome.
Hello, Brittany.
Miss Autumnal, you're very pumpkin-y today.
I'm very excited about pumpkins today.
Mm-hmm. I'll just mention that everyone just got their Dahlia Bakery breakfast sandwich. You know, when you come to the show, the live show, your ticket does include a breakfast sandwich and hot coffee, so... It is much more valuable.
I don't know why you're not here every Tuesday morning.
It's much more valuable than what you might think coming to our show. Instead of just having to hear us and
that's
look at,
right.
Or look at me.
Look at your beautiful face and your hair, though. You look great.
Yeah, got a good guffaw out of that one, didn't we?
We did a little bit.
All right, Baker's Corner. What are we going to talk about today? Fall desserts.
Fall desserts. Actually, it's Pumpkin Week next week. We're very excited for Pumpkin Week over at the Dahlia Bakery because it marks the annual debut of our pumpkin pie becoming available for special order and to buy
right there
in the store.
I already know.
It's the best pumpkin pie in town.
What makes it the best, Brittany?
Well, I think what makes it the best is not only all of the work that goes into finding the most beautiful squash blend we can possibly find, but mm-hmm. there is a hidden layer when you slice into it of ginger snap crumb on the bottom, and it just...
Oh, boy, the audience just went wild.
All you're missing is chocolate, and then they're going
to
go...
Right, yeah. We had to draw the line somewhere.
So you just buy those Nabisco ginger snaps?
Yeah. You know, we just buy it. No. Of course, no. We make our own speculoos cookie, which is basically a ginger snap. They've got a little more spice to it. But so, yeah, we make our own ginger snap crumbs, our own pie crust. We mill our own squash. I mean, start to finish, there was a lot of effort put into this pie, and garnished with beautiful... ginger snap cookie leaves on top.
Let's go back to the pie, the base pie.
Yes.
Because a lot of people, while we appreciate when they come to our bakery and buy a pie, mm-hmm. it's also a time when many people try a pie for the first time, or maybe they've made one or two and they're going to go for it this holiday season. So let's start with the crust.
Just cold fat. Cold everything.
Cold
Even
everything.
If you can get your flour in the fridge for a little while. Mm-hmm. Cold. You don't want that butter to soften up because it's just going to leak out of your crust and make it tough and not.
And then, so the ginger snaps go in with the blind bake?
The ginger, we do a two-time bake, actually. Okay. We blind bake the crust, which means we line it with parchment paper. We actually use a giant coffee filter. And then fill it with, we use lentils, you can use beans, you can buy pie weights, but I think that's silly. And then you bake it in the oven until it's most of the way done. Mm-hmm. At that point, we remove our lentils or whatever your pie weights are and then pack those crumbs into the crust and bake it again.
And so the crust at that point still has a little bit of give to it?
Little give, yeah. Okay. So, and then we bake it again. Okay. And so the pie crust is pretty much fully baked before we've added our pumpkin custard. And the reason that is we cook our pie at a very low temperature. That's one thing with pumpkin pie. Sometimes it cracks. I don't know if anybody's ever had that happen to it's not fun.
That's what the Lord made whipped cream for.
Right, exactly, which is what I've always done in the past.
And ginger snap leaves.
Yes, exactly.
Just give a little bit more of that pumpkin puree.
Yeah, no, we are perfectionists about our pumpkin pies, and we do not want a single crack anywhere. So we bake it at a very low temperature, like creme brulee, or like it's a custard, and so you want to go low and slow.
So let's go back to the crust again, because I'm always...
You're all about that crust.
Well, I just feel like people often underbake. And so give me a color you want that crust to look like when it's done. And it's not just going to be as dark as your hair.
No.
But is it like an acorn? Is it... Is it weak coffee?
It's weak coffee or creamy coffee, I guess. It's sort of
like a
butterscotch. Blonde. Yeah.
Butterscotch. Not blonde.
Not blonde. Dark blonde.
Dishwater blonde, as my mom used to call it.
Not the most delicious term for
that was just because of your neighbor.
When you're at the Bartels, is that in the dye aisle? Is dishwater blonde?
So you want it to be just sort of a lightly toasted,
golden.
I'd say golden. I mean, it's
maple syrup
in the very center. It's going to be set. Let's say that it's not going to look wet. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The crust will be baked through.
Okay.
It'll start showing the little bubbles that happen as the water expands the crust from the butter.
There's something that happens to crust. The butter sort of solidifies, and so it doesn't look moist when you...
Right.
And then you pull it out at that point, and that's when you pack your ginger snap crumbs in.
Now, here's another crust question, because I think this is hotly debated. You are an all-butter crust?
We are not.
No. Tell me more, because
I know there's... We are mostly butter with just a smidgen of shortening.
Yes.
And I've always felt that way. I use a blend of fats anytime I make a crust, whether it's cream cheese and butter or leaf lard and butter. But you need the flavor from the butter, and then you need the performance of the shortening to give it that really flaky texture.
I like leaf lard.
Leaf lard's pretty cool stuff. It's hard to get, so we just go with good old Crisco. It's worked for years and years.
That is what I grew up making my pies out of, is a blend of shortening, again, for those flaky layers because of its performance. But the butter is really...
You need that flavor. And one little trick we do, and I mentioned cold fats, we actually measure out our shortening that we're going to use, pinch it into little pieces, scatter it on a sheet tray, throw it in the freezer. You want that frozen solid, too.
Okay, let's get to the filling.
Let's get to that filling. I think we should talk about the squash blend.
So how do you pick a good squash? Heavy. I find it heavy.
It's heavy, exactly. It's heavy, yeah. And you, when you cut into it, I don't know if you've ever cut into a squash that's maybe a bit old, or it just, it looks like it's dried out in the center. Yeah. It's kind of spongy.
Looks like me.
Spongy and dried out like
spongy
Tom.
Spongy and dried out.
Yeah.
You just washed a shirt.
That one looks too much like Tom. Let's get that one out of here.
Let's put him back in the water.
Okay, so you want heavy. Now you've seeded it, and you now want to roast the squash, right?
Yes. So
whether
we just cut it in half.
Acorns,
yes.
Whatever.
Yeah, cut it in half, scoop out the seeds, and then flip it cut side down into a pan with a little bit of water, just like an inch, just to help the steaming. Cover it with foil and then put it in the oven for, I mean, it really varies, and we don't even really pay attention to how hot our oven is. This is the part where it's kind of a no-brainer. You just throw it in until it's done. And it's done when you pinch it and it just totally gives.
And why do you put the foil? It seems to me you'd want some caramelization on there.
We don't want caramelization. We just want pure steam.
And if you keep the peel on, does that work too?
It gives it more flavor with the peel on.
And is caramelization just a little... You're concerned about texture? You want it super smooth?
We want it super smooth, exactly.
So you don't really care about the flavor?
Well, the squash itself. If you're using a delicious squash.
Over texture.
We just went through the process of picking out a blend of squash.
Now you've scooped it.
Yes.
Now you put it over cheesecloth and a strainer, right?
First, we mill it. And at home, you can use a food processor. Okay. So we're just getting it nice and smooth. And then you put it over cheesecloth and drain it overnight and get all of that moisture
overnight.
Out. Overnight.
Let's get real about this.
So, yeah.
I mean,
so
if you want to see without
so this
even...
Is Saturday, you're making your dough. You're pre-baking your pie dough.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're also making your puree and you let it drain overnight. You're not finishing until
you're
Sunday.
You're not finished. You probably got to make your cookie crumbs, too.
Yeah.
Okay, where are we now? We have drained our squash.
We're explaining why our pies are $38.
Exactly. And honestly, this is all made by people with health insurance and a livable wage. So.
Yeah, exactly.
So then we take our drained squash, and then we make a squash butter. And that's where we take soft butter, our drained squash, and maple syrup, and blend it all together.
Uh-huh.
And that's what everybody's doing right now. This is our prep.
Okay.
At that point, you can just throw it in the freezer if you want, and then... wait till you're ready to bake your pie. But if you're doing it all in one go, then you're going to make sort of a custard, a creme anglaise. You're going to cook it on the stove with eggs. It's almost like a really thick ice cream base. And then you're finally done, and you're ready to pour it into your
pie
shell.
You cool that off.
You mix that all together, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you actually don't cool it off.
Oh, you
don't.
It's
best if it's warm. If it goes warm, going into the shell, you're going to get best results. We've also found that actually letting that mixture sit overnight is better because you get a smoother crust, or a smoother filling. But
then it's cold.
If we're already a week into this project. Then you bake it at about 200 degrees for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and then you finally have pumpkin pie.
Wait, but do you have to let it sit?
You do need... I mean, I think you need to let it sit at least, I don't know, 4 hours in the refrigerator.
I was going to say, that is the cruelest part about it all. You know, it's one thing to put all this effort into it and puree the things and make the butter and the glaze, but the waiting, the 4 hours.
Waiting's the hardest
part. Before you can cut it,
right? Before you can cut it.
But if you're doing this for Thanksgiving, this is one thing you can do ahead and get out of the way.
That's a good point.
So I retrieve. You start on Tuesday, you do the first part, you finish on Wednesday, and by Thursday you can eat the damn pie.
Or if you're like us, you start now.
I'm sorry. I'm going to have a lot more respect for pie from now on.
Exactly. People don't realize.
No, of
and
course.
We haven't even talked about the fact that you have to pick the seeds in December to plant in February in the greenhouse, to put in the garden in April, to grow the squash and pick them in October.
There's a lot of love in this pie.
Pie with love. That's
pie.
Good.
I love pie. All right. Up next, food for thought, tasty trivia. We're going to find out if Miss Bartleben is going to hang with us or she has to go and make some pie on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. And we're back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. We're talking pies with Chef Brittany Bartleben. And now it's time for food for thought, tasty trivia. I'm Tom Douglas.
And
Terry's got a mouthful of Dahlia Bakery breakfast sandwich.
I'm Katie O.
And one thing I wanted to add to our pie conversation, as if I didn't add enough, is that if you're using last year's pumpkin pie spice, and you're doing all that work, you're crazy.
Yeah,
it's not that much more money to go buy fresh spice by small quantities and start with fresh spice, not a year-old spice or a 5-year-old spice.
Yes.
Okay, Katie O, you're going to run our our deal today.
Yes, after that public service announcement on spices. We are playing Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. This is where each of you get five questions. Brittany, you're familiar with this game.
Sure am.
They're all food-related questions. Don't worry. That's everyone's specialty here. And whoever gets the most correct wins, and whoever gets the least amount correct is obviously the loser. The loser has to give something to one of our audience members, and today it's Jim. That's why we asked you your name. You're probably like, why do they want to know my name? Well, that's because you are going to be the person that the chefs are playing for. Thierry, what will you give away to Jim should you lose?
Jim, have you been to Luc yet?
I have.
Have you been to brunch?
Would you ever go back?
Yes.
Have you been to brunch?
Not for brunch, no.
There you go. Brunch for two at Luc, Saturday or Sunday.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Brittany, if you lose, what will you give
away?
Well,
let's do lunch at the Dahlia Lounge.
Ooh.
Lunch for two.
Lunch at the Dahlia Lounge.
Very nice. Tom Douglas?
Tis the season to be thinking about your pie purchases from the Dahlia Bakery.
I'm thinking about it.
I'm going to give you a head start with a $50 gift certificate to the Dahlia Bakery.
Nice.
To pick out anything you'd like. That would cover even our coconut cream pie.
All right, let's jump into this quiz. Thierry Rotaro, you like to go first.
All right, here we go.
Your first question, where is whale bacon a popular food? Would that be Alaska, Japan, Iceland, or Norway?
I'm going to go with Iceland.
That is incorrect. It's Japan. Japan is where it is a popular food. Okay, your next question. What do locusts, grasshoppers, bald locusts, and beetles have in common? Are they, A, all may be eaten by Jews, B, all have a distinct nutty flavor and delightful crunch, C, most significant crop pests, or D, included in African Chex Mix?
I'm going to go with number two, the crunchy, delicious, and nutty.
You know what? I would have thought that too, but actually they all may be eaten by Jews. All are kosher according to Leviticus 11:22.
Everybody. I knew that too, but I didn't think that was a subject.
Who didn't know that? All right. Finish this food phrase. What is a couch blank? What kind of food would go?
Potato.
The couch potato. That is correct. All right. Your next question. The Greenland delicacy Kiviak, I believe is how it's pronounced. Is it a seal flipper pie? Is it poutine? Is it ox stuffed in seal stomach and buried for a year? Or is it penguin jerky?
Wow, all of those sound so delicious.
It's very extreme.
I'm going to go with the first one.
The seal flipper pie?
Yeah.
Number one is seal flipper pie, and what we were looking for was ox stuffed in seal stomach and buried for a year.
Can't make that one up.
No.
Yeah, no, you really can't. All right, and your final question, Thierry. Ooh. Finish this food phrase. Just my cup of blank.
My cup of tea?
That is correct. Very nice. Two out of five.
Jen, that's not a high showing today.
We have good
hope
days,
you liked
we have
Luke.
Bad days.
I hope you like Norway, Iceland, and what was the other one?
All right, Brittany, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Finish this food phrase. Just what I like, as easy as blank.
Pie.
That's correct. Yes, very nice. Brittany, which is a real product marketed in the U.S. by an American company? Is it Muncha Roach, Cricket Licket, Snakeums, or Snail Slimers?
Oh, God.
They all sound great. Like a... which said the penguin bladder.
The third one.
Snake M's?
Yeah.
Snake M's. No, it's actually B, Cricket Licket. It's a lollipop encasing a cricket.
Okay.
Delicious.
I'm okay with getting that one wrong.
I saw scorpion lollipops in Phoenix yesterday.
Did you? You see so much. That wasn't your taste of the week, though.
No.
Okay. Brittany, a Japanese food with a texture like loose custard in Japan, known as children of the clouds, consists of A, boiled bird's nest, B, strained tofu, C, fish sperm, or D, contents of birds' stomachs.
I'm going to go with strained tofu and hope that's the answer.
Oh, No, it's not. It's fish sperm.
Do you have any that aren't gross?
Not really.
These are great questions today.
Really interesting.
Brittany, a blank a day keeps the doctor away.
An apple.
That's right. Very nice. And your final question. Traditional meals of the Igbo in Nigeria begin by the ritual sharing of A, a nice Chianti, B, a kola nut, C, palm sugar cone, or D, river clay. Let's go with
with palm sugar cone?
It's actually a cola nut.
Oh, okay.
All right. That's okay.
Tied
right.
with Terry.
Wow.
With Terry.
I thought I was doing... Yeah. Brittany, I'm glad you're doing as great as I am.
I know.
See, all I used to
like
do
they bad. Vary between really easy or really weird and hard.
Tom, yours is first a fill-in-the-blank. Too many cooks spoil the what?
Soup.
Broth.
Broth.
I'd always heard soup.
Have you?
Yeah, I'd always heard soup. Yeah, that's what my mom always said.
Well, it's a 50-50 split, so it seems like both are acceptable. Tom, I'm going to give it to you simply because...
I'm a good sport. I'll go either way.
Okay, I'm going to give it to you.
All
I'm
right.
going to give it to you. Your next question.
It works.
Pre-Columbian Aztecs, dig back into your history books here. Pre-Columbian Aztecs
chocolate.
Were known to eat, is it cakes made of pond scum, weasels, human flesh, or all of the above?
All of the above.
That's right. Tom, what are you if you're cool as a blank?
Cucumber.
Yes, that's very much correct. Your next question, a bloater in present-day England is it haggis, salted herring, a burst banger, or eel pie?
A bloater. I've never heard haggis. I go to Scotland a lot. I've never heard haggis called a bloater.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly,
would make,
it looks, certainly
looks
that way.
It certainly sounds like a sausage would be a
I'm
bloater.
I'm going to say a burst banger.
Yeah.
A burst banger. It's actually salted herring.
Salted herring.
All right.
Oh,
and your
wow.
final question. Marinara means sailor in the feminine form. But why would tomato sauce be named sailor? Is it because it's cooked quickly with minimal heat as on shipboard? Is it because it's always containing anchovies? C, it's a favorite of the sailors in Naples. Or D, who knows?
I like that. I'll go with
the
sailors in Naples. Naples.
That is incorrect. It's actually because it's cooked quickly with minimal heat as on shipboard. Tom, that means you still beat these other two losers. But the losers are tied, so we're going to have a little slap off on the counter
here. Who loses
the
most?
Slam on the counter.
Who loses the absolute most here?
All right.
Finish this phrase. That's the way the blank crumbles.
Cookie.
That's right.
I slapped.
That's right.
Yes,
Brittany did slap. So she wins. That means
the pastry chef won it.
You lose this round of Tasty Trivia.
It's all right. You're coming to Luke for brunch.
Going to Luke for brunch. Thank you. If you want to be part of the show, you can send us a note on Facebook or Twitter at Seattle Kitchen. You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. The show is produced by Tina Noll at Large Media. Our associate producer is Sarah Leibovitz, and our sound engineer is Sean, don't call me Del Torre. If you'd like to be part of our studio audience like these lovely folks, go to hotstovesociety.com and buy tickets for only $15. Comes with a Dahlia Bakery breakfast sandwich and hot coffee. Also, remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can subscribe to Stitcher or our podcast through Apple Podcasts or download the Cairo Radio app and search for Seattle Kitchen.
Thanks for listening.
Have a great weekend.